First of all, Frelich Chanukah, welcome. It's a pleasure to sit together and to think about some of what I think are these enduring questions. And they're just more prominent seasonally as we sit on Chanukah and we look at what I think is quite a personality disorder when it comes to Greek culture. On the one hand, sitting around our families and looking at Chanukah books or storybooks, there's this characterization of the Greek culture and of the Greeks as these scary, cruel, ominous beings who have threatened the existence of the Jewish nation, against whom we always fight, and we have this incredible luck and miracle of survival. And yet, if you go through your regular course of life today, in not only today, but certainly today in 21st century America, you'd be very hard-pressed to pull apart all of the ways in which Greek culture has influenced and inspired. And it's hard to imagine where that amazing clash of civilizations is that the kindergartner version of Chanukah helps us remember every single year. Because indeed, our curricula, our lifestyles, much of our basic ideology, many of our assumptions, our language, the words we use in our values, the conversations that we have, are fully entrenched in Greek culture and have been very much benefited by the ideas that have emerged from Greek history and Greek philosophy particularly. It's quite the conundrum to really face and to notice that, yes, existentially, certainly in the times of Chanukah, Hellenism presented a great threat, was a cultural, nihilistic opponent for Judaism, and yet, in the times that have passed, we have the Rambam, in the words of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, almost views Aristotle as half a prophet, someone who has given us so much insight and so much knowledge and so much understanding. We have not only from within the Jewish community and the lines of the great Jewish thinkers, we have many who just would credit the philosophy and the contributions to study and knowledge that emerge from the history of the Greeks as being the foundational pillars of our world of wisdom, so to speak. And how we then fully integrate this dual relationship, this two sides of one coin, where in fact there is some sense that we were and are at risk by becoming partners, as it were, with Greek culture, and yet we were and are indebted to some of the contributions of Greek culture and the way that it's enriched or beautified our own. And so, you know, spoiler alert for everybody, the answer to the big question is yes, we can beautify Judaism with Greek culture. The real question is why? And the real question is, in what dimensions? And can we pinpoint where indeed the conflict exists, if it isn't as large and as broad as Greek culture? Where indeed is the different orientation between a Jewish, enriched by a Greek philosophy, perhaps, orientation of the world, and a Greek orientation that is threatening to a Jewish existence? That's the ultimate real question. And really to bring us back to Chazal's understanding of the value within, that resides within Greek culture, I thought we should start from the pasuk that keeps being referred to whenever the discussion of what is beautiful, what is wonderful, what is admirable in Greece, is always takes us back to this original pasuk, Yafta Elokim Yafet V'yishkon Ba'olei Shem. What's the origin of the story here? It's a very strange context. In fact, the pasuk really goes a little bit early. We really have to go a little. We have to go one pasuk earlier where we talk about Baruch Elokei Shem. It's not just Yafta Elokim Yafet, but the context of this story is one in which as much of Bereishit is archetypical. We're looking at paradigms. We're not only looking at individuals. In this context, we find that Noah, who is at this point in history the father of all, right? Who presumably will be the genetic father of all mankind after the flood. Noah has three sons. Those three sons are archetypes, so to speak, of future nations. And in Noah's temporary fall after the flood, Noah, in his efforts to recognize the incredible burden that is being placed on him to really start the world after him, we find his three sons notice this diminished capacity that he's in, and the pasuk describes that Ham violates his father in one form or another, literally or figuratively. His father is now being defathered. Ham is no longer recognizing the authoritative hierarchy. And in response to that, we have Shem and Yafet, with great dignity and respect, trying to restore some component of what was lost by Ham's violation of his father. And in response, when Noah awakes and finds that this is the new set of conditions that he is under, he decides that clearly, and we can notice that this is not about individuals, that this is going to be about how these individuals become the archetypes for the further generations, because Noah doesn't respond to Ham per se, he responds to Ham's grandson. Canaan is now going to be cursed, right, for all generations. And Noah blesses Shem and Yafet for their efforts, but interestingly contextualizes it as Baruch Elokei Shem. And then Shem and Yafet are blessed following the fact that there is a theological component to what Noah perceives to be important as the continuity will follow from that moment. Recognize, of course, that this is the last action, last deed, and last words of Noah. Next pasuk, we're informed Noah dies, lives another 350 years, none of which is significant to comment on, but the torch has been passed. These three archetypes are now responsible for the future generations, and Noah's last action is this blessing and the curse that he bestows upon not his children per se, but on their generations. So Yafta Elokim LeYafet, V'yishkon Ba'olei Shem, V'hi Knan Eved Lamo repeats itself poetically, but the question as to how you read the first segment of this pasuk indicates a little bit about the ways in which Chazal, the way in which the Rishonim and Achronim think about this pasuk, indicates how they thought about Greece per se, who's perceived to be Yafet, and Shem, who is perceived to be the ancestor of the Jewish nation. What should the relationship be like for them? So let's look at a couple of the parshanut and see how it is expanded to include Greek culture. Yafta Elokim LeYafet, we look at Rashi. Miturgem Yafte Yarchiv. Rashi is basing himself on Onklos and on Targum Yonatan, and basically they're saying that the shoresh of Yafet is that Yafet will be expanded. He will be enriched. It's an enlargement. That could be politically, geographically, in terms of the power, or in terms of numbers, right? So he will be expanded and enlarged. And then the question is, V'yishkan bo'olei shem, yishra shchinato b'Yisrael. What is the subject of a Yishkon? Is it Yafet or Hashem? Yafta Elokim LeYafet. God will give Yafet Yafet. He will get more Yafet, whatever that is. He will become enriched. He will become enlarged. Or we'll see another interpretation. He will become the source of all beauty. He will become the source of all aesthetic culture. And then Vayishkon Ba'olei Shem. Who's the source of Vayishkon? It is either Yafet will rest in Ba'olei Shem, Yafta Elokim Yafet, all those qualities that God gives Yafet will now reside in Ba'olei Shem, or it stops, full stop. Yafta Elokim Yafet, Yafet gets Yafta, and Vayishkon Ba'olei Shem, and Hashem will rest Ba'olei Shem. And God will then not only offer something to Yafet, but God will offer to Shem that higher spiritual dimension that his Shekhinah will rest in the Ohel of Shem. That's the way that the Parshanim split this Pasuk. If you look at the second component of Rashi, Vayishkon Ba'olei Shem, Yishra Shekhinato B'Yisrael, Medrash Chachamim Afal Pisha Yafet, even though Hashem gives this enriched status to Yafet, Shebana Koresh Shahaya Mibne Yafet Bayit Sheni. Koresh is the descendant of Yafet. Persian Empire, the Greek Empire follows. Lo Sharta Bo Shechina. They don't get the Shechina. They just get Yafet. They just get beauty, they get aesthetics, or they get, for Koresh, it would have been really the political dominion that we see described in Megillat Esther. The Persian Empire, and the way in which it is enriched geographically. But the Heichan Sharta, where will the Shechina rest? B'miktash Rishon Shabana Shlomo Shai B'nei Shem. So it gets split. You get beauty, aesthetics, political power, and Shem gets the higher, so to speak, reward of the Shechina of Hashem, the spiritual dimension, the connection to God. Of course, we know that Chazal credits Shem with his grandson Aver as having established the first yeshiva. Just to notice that there's a recognition of the continuity of the mission of God within Shem. And of course, just the name Shem, and obviously the name Yefet, reflect those two destinies. Indeed, even throughout Sefer Bereishit, we do see Shem, the word Shem, Bashem, when Yaakov visits Beit El, right? And he declares that he is there to make Amizbeach, Bashem. They recognize that is Hashem. The word, the name is Bashem. Bashem what? Bashem Hashem. So even in their own name, there is a qualification for this bracha to reside with them so that they now can fulfill that entire destiny. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch takes this even further. He's always been very linguistically sensitive to the words that are used in Chumash, really following along with the tradition of Ibn Ezra, carefully teasing apart all of the Shorashim to see where it is that we draw our meaning from. The cutouts here on the sources on your page, the paragraphs were a bit shifted, so if you can follow me instead of just reading straight, we're going to start at the bottom left, which says, reflects the personal character traits. Where Shamshon Raphael Hirsch says that is that as you look at these three sons, their names reflect their character traits. And in fact, that Shem, there have three archetypes here. We have Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Cham is that tyrannical brute force, the material might, the one who believes the might is right, and given a moment where there's weakness, even in a natural order, as he saw his father somehow diminished, took advantage of that moment, those are the nations of the world who operate with that assumption in place. Brute force, material might, there's a certain element of thinking about how it is that we accomplish our destinies. What's the mechanism that is the most powerful? That's the Cham approach. Yafet, according to Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, is an entirely different being. Let's look at the bottom right side. It says, in contrast to the nations that are really driven by material force and by brute force, it says there are other nations that devote their energies to beauty, nations that are characterized by their cultivation of the arts and of aesthetics. They recognize that there is a higher ideal to which man must ascend. They teach man to value beauty, to spread a cloth of elegance over crude sensuality. Guided by grace and beauty, they engage in spiritual endeavors such as poetry, music, and the fine arts. A nation that promotes these values, which win over the heart and appeal to the emotions, exemplify the character of Yafet. It does a linguistic analysis of the words Yafet and where its roots are, and this is on the left-hand top side. Again, I apologize for it being a little bit out of order. And that's what it means by God will extend the bounds of Yafet. Laharchiv doesn't necessarily mean a political boundary, doesn't mean geographic, it doesn't mean numeric. What it means is, if you look to the middle, Pata denotes emotional openness, like from Petach, to external impressions and influence. Just a peti, like a peti, which is often referred to as a simpleton, right? A peti is someone who can be easily persuaded or even deceived. Pit'om, something for which we're unprepared that suddenly occurs, related to patach, pada, pada, all of which denotes opening. Yafet is the hifil form, and he concludes by saying, and this means that Hashem gives Yafet the capacity to open hearts, to dominate in that domain, to reach people through various mechanisms, which is often more connected to the emotional side of things. The arts, the music, where a person can internalize certain values of aesthetics that might otherwise not be accessed without those mediums. And in fact, Yafet and the Greek culture does exemplify and does take that blessing in many generations and continuously to its greatest height. What do we do with that, though? Where is the value to Judaism? What is the relationship of the shame to Yafet? If you look over to the right side at the very top, Rav Hirsch suggests what that relationship is. Considering the historical reality, we may say that the fullest flowering of Yafet was Yavan, okay, ancient Greece. The fullest flowering of shame is Aver, the Hebrews, the people of Israel, which proclaim B'Shem Hashem amongst the nations of the world. Until this very day, only, this is a pretty extreme statement, only the descendants of Yafet and Shem, the Greeks and the Jews, have been the real educators and teachers of humanity from different domains, right? One from the aesthetic and one from the spiritual intellectual domain.
Is Rome considered to be a derivative?
Of Yafet, yes, it is. Yes, they do connect. In fact, it's obviously it's not a strict designation of, even if Paras, if the Persians are also thrown into that category, we see that it's a larger category that qualifies for culture. Yeah, it is a sweeping category. And I think that is, it's by the characteristics and not necessarily by descendancy. The characteristics that shape a culture, which Greece seems to exemplify and others continue and follow. Even, so let's just see, all the spiritual treasures of mankind derive from Shem and from Yafet. Even today, every new cultural educational advance is a continuation of their contribution. Even the spiritual contributions of the Romans came from the Greeks. Yafet brings aesthetic refinement, Shem enlightens the spirit and refines morality. The culture of Greece and the Torah of Israel have been powerful, dynamic forces in the work of educating mankind. In comparison, the rest of the world has been like passive raw material. So it's a pretty strong statement, but there's a strong connection. Rav Hirsch would never go so far as to say that the clash of civilizations, which is so prominently the theme of Hanukkah, right, tears asunder the mission of these two nations. It doesn't. We have a shared mission and a different directive, perhaps, and a different mechanisms. But there is a shared mission that both nations, aware or unaware of that mission, have continued, right? Whereas the philosophers of the Greeks are saying, we must seek understanding, we must uncover knowledge, the rabbis or the studiers of Shem and of the Jewish tradition are asking, how do we fulfill the knowledge and the insight that God has given us? There's knowledge for knowledge's sake, and there's knowledge for service sake. And those are one of the two pillars of these communities. It's interesting to know, by the way, that also Aristotle, just as Shamshon Yerfalel Hirsch has these three archetypes, Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics has three archetypes as well in terms of the nations and the types of people. He would have them, one being someone who seeks the life of pleasure, one who seeks the life of two who seeks the life of honor, and the third is someone who seeks the life of contemplation. So that would be the philosopher. The philosopher is replaced really by a tzaddik, by shame in Rav Hirsch's breakdown. In any case, what we have though is that there is clearly a connection and there's a valued connection, and then there's a shared mission that needs to be clarified for us if in fact we're supposed to draw some lines and recognize where those differences are. How do we connect to this very divergent view of the Greek legacy? The Emek, if we look at the bottom of the page, the Netziv tells us, not only is it that Yefet has its own contribution to our society, not only does Greek culture bring something into the world that then we might be able to shift, maybe we're supposed to just not engage and wait for that unfolding knowledge that Rav Schachter spoke about this morning to be introduced to the world, and we hijack it and utilize it in our own Torah way. Maybe it's more of a passive process that Hashem offers it to this world, and then through Yefet, and then we get to reshape it. Are we really fully engaged in the same type of knowledge seeking? Is there really a shared process here? The Netziv would argue that if you look into the middle of the middle of the quote, mashma'o. Okay. The Netziv will argue this is one consistent sentence. This is not split in the middle. It's Yafta Elokim liYafet. Hashem gives beauty and aesthetics to Yafet. Ve'yishkon ba'ol Hashem, and there is a inherent relationship, a tight bond with what Yafet is supposed to do with that beauty and aesthetics, and how it's supposed to be connected to Ol Hashem. Mashma'o, what is his interpretation? It means sheYisrael natzro leheitiv emunat kol am, that Bnei Yisrael is created to improve and enhance the emunah of all people. Shenikra brit lahair derech eretz shelahem, and it is able to come and understand our mission and to enlighten and enhance their way, their conduct, their derech eretz, their way of understanding the world. In fact, going to the top line of the Netziv, Vayishkon ba'ol Hashem, he would say, Od barcho ba'anashim chachmei lev, sheyirgashu chachmat zer Hashem ba'ol Aleihem, shehi elokit ve'ein laket v'tachlit. That what the Netziv is saying is that Yefet, even though their domain is aesthetics, Yefet will be enticed and needs to appreciate that if they take their aesthetics into the tents of shame, in there they will find even more beauty, a beauty that has no end, a beauty and a knowledge that is elokit, that is spiritual, that is not finite in the same sense that perhaps aesthetics is. Aesthetics can be, when you have knowledge for its own sake, when you have beauty for its own sake, it has a certain lifespan. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily become timeless. Unless it can continue to speak the language of relevance to the next generations. And what the Netziv is trying to argue is that beauty can exist independent of anything else and independent of purpose. But our goal is to bring that beauty into the Ol of Shame. And even Yefet will learn to appreciate and be attracted and enticed to enter into the Ohel of Shame, because that will give them a greater eternity. But more than our need to invite Yefet into the Ohel of Shame, that's like what he said the first, Mashmo sheYisrael notu lehitiv emunat kol am. Everybody, we have the ability to increase and enhance and improve the emunah of all nations, Yefet particularly. Then he says, v'od nichla bebrachazu. This is a further benefit of inviting, let's say, Yefet into our tents is de'meharchavat ha'chayim shel Yefet yagia to'elet l'ol Hashem. It's even further than that. it's not just that we want them to come in to benefit from us. It's that when we invite them in, right, their orientation, hachavat hachayim, that expansion that is referred to in this bracha, that their borders, their boundaries, their orientation, their hearts, the way that they expand understanding the world, hachavat hachayim of Yafet, will yagia toelet la'ol Hashem, offers us a toelet. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein will say that if you just stay with the crude break that our coloring books offer us, which is appropriate for the Chag, if we stay with that crude break between Judaism and Greek culture, we are cutting ourselves off from the opportunity to not only to appreciate what the fine pinpointed conflict is, but to appreciate all of the benefits of Greek culture, which we, by the way, are doing anyhow. So not to allow ourselves to just ignore that level of hypocrisy by saying that there is this clash of cultures, we don't quite know what it is, but we're absolutely different, right? Where the continuous theme within Chazal tells us that there is indeed a clash. We need to know what it is, because in its broadest strokes, there's a bracha that we share of bringing insight and bringing a toelet to the world with that bracha that Noach via what he calls Baruch Elokei Shem. And putting Elokei Shem there is important, because Noach is saying, I'm giving you this bracha because you are the continuity of this mission that I've been given. My life is about to be over and I'm passing it on to you. And Sefer Avos and Bereishis, we see that theme continuing from the very beginning.
What is toelet?
Toelet means a purpose. There actually is a purpose. It's not just that you're offering something to them. Ah, they'll be attracted by the Torah. They'll join they'll come into our tent, and all of a sudden their life will be enhanced. So will ours. There's a toelet and a purpose to that connection between Yavon and Shem, between Yefet and Shem. So let's try to see if we can get a little bit closer as to what it is that everyone is worried about, and how it is that we can draw some of the lines between Chachma Yivanit, between this Greek culture that gets such a bad rap, and yet seems to have such great potential. Okay, the Torah Shlema is an amazing Sefer for anyone who hasn't had access to it, because on every pasuk in Torah, it will reference you to the Gemarot that bring agadot and midrashim on that pasuk. So instead of just going straight to the Gemara, I wanted to bring it to you through the Torah Shlema so people will know. If you're learning just parsha and you want to know what the Gemara has to say on this pasuk, go through the Torah Shlema. Yeah.
What Sefer did you say?
Torah Shlema, top of page 3. Torah Shlema, it's a compilation, so you just have the Chumash as a regular Chumash. It actually has Unklos and Targum Yonatan there also, and then the Torah Shlema has underneath each of the Psukim the different Gemarot or Agadot that are related to those Psukim. So what do we have on Yafta Elokim LeYafet, Yishkon Bo LeShem? We have the Megillah, which I'm not sure on the electronic version, for some reason, the first word, some of the letters got switched. Instead of hapasrim, it's supposed to say hasvarim. The Gemara, I don't know why. The Gemara is discussing what language are we allowed to write svarim in. What language are we allowed to write either Sifrei Kodesh in, or specifically mezuzah and tefillin? Okay? Are we allowed to write them in any language? So the Tanna Kamma says, "Hasvarim nechavim b'chol lashon." You can write svarim in any language. That's the argument. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, "Af b'svarim lo hitiru sheichtavu el yivanit." Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, "No, only the Greek language is reserved because it has a certain higher quality, a certain elite status. Only those educated in our society speak this language, and therefore it is a." It's not thought of as a diminution in the status of the ksav if you write it in Greek. It's a pretty extraordinary privilege to reserve for Greek language. And at the end, Rabbi Yochanan, ma tama de Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. What's his reasoning? Amar kare kra yafta lekim liyafet vishken bo leshem. Dvarav shel yafet yub o leshem. That's the pasuk that gives him the logic for saying the words of shame can be translated into the words of yafet. Yes, it's Chet Teves. Yes, and it's coming up in right after Hanukkah, which is ironic. Actually, it's right after the translation. It's a great question. In fact, I believe, I'm sorry, I'm not, I don't remember exactly, but I think that Rav Hirsch discusses that also on this psukim. And he would argue that the difference in that situation where I believe it was Ptolemy Philadelphus in creating the library in Alexandria, the first library in Alexandria, collected 72 Chachamim and put them in separate rooms and had them each translate Sifrei Kodesh into Greek, and that was considered a great affront and a threat to Judaism. And Rav Hirsch would explain that the difference there was that this was an imposition. The Chachamim, and the fact was that they were put into rooms. He goes very specifically, says that this was like a jailed imposition, and this was a challenge to their faith. And as opposed to a situation where Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is saying, you can translate it into Greek, because it's not the translation. This is very important. It's not the translation, it's not the language. It's the context of which this is done that's so important. And that means that, and this will emerge pretty soon in the other Makorot as well, there is the possibility that it is value neutral. Greek wisdom or Greek culture or Greek language might be just value neutral and totally dependent on whether you're using this value neutral material to fulfill the bracha of Yafta Elokim Yafet V'yishkan Bo Leishem or for other purposes. Exactly. And that, and I think when you look at the Makorot like this, certainly Rav Shimon ben Gamliel would not be counter-positioning himself, right, to say that, no, indeed, Greek is awful, but we are able to translate it. It's really the context here, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel saying, in our environment, translating into Greek is going to raise its prestige, and it is of great value. I'm certain that there may be art displays of biblical verses that could be perceived and understood to be a great diminution to the value and respect that's being given to the text. So this isn't in the slightest bit about saying anything goes. This is about saying, if indeed we have that carefully calibrated relationship of Yafta Elokim Yafet, not as a separate pasuk, but as part of one bracha, V'yishkan bo leishem. It's very fascinating. Two children, right? Two entirely different archetypes. Two, you know, progenitors for the rest of humanity. And yet their bracha has to be linked, right? And that's part of the challenge. Do you want to ask?
The important distinction between that Gemara and the institution is direction. Because the translation of institution was to enable the Greeks or the non-Jews access to the Torah. Here, it's access of the
Right, to the educated elite who are speaking more Greek than speaking Hebrew. And I think that that's similarly one of the phenomenon, let's say, with the Bayer of I believe Moses Mendelssohn, who then translated the Chumash, right? He would write the Chumash in German letters, and people were outraged. How could you do that? It wasn't to try to teach non-Jews the Torah, it was to teach Jews who only spoke German and give them the access. So the contextualization, the purpose, the driven, the ontology of the goal is so important to recognizing that there's potential, there's great bracha present in that effort, if that's the point. Okay, let's look at the next source, which is in Sota. The Gemara in Sota raises another objection that people may have. It isn't just the broad cultural assumptions that Greece is awful, But there is a line of argumentation or a tradition that Chochma Yivanit or Chochma or certain Sifrei Chochma of the Greeks are Asur. And the Gemara tells us here, Bepulmos Shaltitus, Gazru al Atarot Kalot. And it goes on, this is a discussion about after the destruction or after the conquering. The Gemara starts with Titus and ends with Aristobulus. So there's a confluence of historical layers being discussed at the same time. Okay, which means that they're talking about an earlier decree that then was either reenacted, but don't get confused by the fact that we're talking about different historical periods at the same time. After one point in conquest and then once again at another point in conquest, they decreed that Kalot should not wear these types of crowns. Okay, and you have to just, if we're going to skip down to the next paragraph, and v'shelo yilmad et b'no yivanit. Two big decrees were made. Kalot should not wear these things, and boys should not be taught Greek. What does that mean? It's obvious, and it continues. The strain comes back a couple of different times, historical layers into historical experiences. When the Jews are being conquered, we are once again reminded that it's asur to teach Yevanit. So let's look a little bit about what that means. Kishatzaru malchei beit chashmonai zelzeh. When the Hasmonean dynasty was internally striven and broken, Hayahorkinos mi bachutz v'Aristobulos mi b'fnim. You had Horkinos outside of the siege and Aristobulos inside the siege. V'chol yom v'yom hoyu mishalshalin dinarim b'kupa umalin lahen tzmidim. Every day they would pass dinars in some type of container over the wall of the siege, and then they would give them their animals so that they could continue with the karbanot. Okay? I'm sorry. Second paragraph in Talmud Bavli, Masachet Sota. Now, right after the second line of the second paragraph, Umalin Lahen Tmidin. Hayasham Zaken Echad. There was an elder man, Shahe Amakir B'Chachmat Yivanit. An elder Jewish man, it seems, who knew Chachmat Yivanit. La'az Lahen B'Chachmat Yivanit. He hinted, he tricked somehow them in Chachma Yevanit, Amar Lahen, and he said to them, who's them? The Greeks. Kol zman she'oskim ba'avoda, ein nimsarim b'yadeichem. Well, this siege is just not going to work. As long as they're able to give karbanot, as long as they're able to continue in their avoda, you're never going to win. Right? So HaKadosh Baruch is going to be on their side. Right, so he's giving them a hint as to how they're really going to become successful. Lemachar, the next day, shalshulahem dinarim, they sent out dinarim, bakupa, in this little thing going up and down outside the siege wall, the ha'alulahem chazir. And they instead brought up a set of an animal that they could do being for a carbon, they gave him a chazir. Kevan sheyigi alachetzi achoma, as they got to half of the wall, na'at tziparnav, the hoofs of the pig clung onto the wall of Yerushalayim. Eretz Yisrael arbama od parsa, and the whole Eretz Yisrael shook and trembled because this chazir was now being matame the walls of Yerushalayim. Otasha amru, at that same time they said, arur adam sheagdil chazirim. Okay, should never be allowed to raise pigs in Israel. It's another political issue. And the arur adam sheyilmad livno chachma yivanit. And cursed is a man who teaches his son Greek wisdom. So what do we do? This is just an agada that exemplifies the strain within Chazal that says chachma yivanit has inside of it some kind of tuma, some kind of threat, some kind of damage. Yeah.
When you say chachma yivanit, like
the way of thinking of the Greeks, or? No, I'm shaking my head. That's the right question. What's included in this category? What?
He told them something. About Judaism, not about Bachman.
Great. Why was he able to do it, though? They're talking about. He knew their language. So is this Lashon Yevanit, or is it? Is it a corpus of knowledge? Is it a library set? Or is it a language issue? If it's a language issue, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel already said that Yevanit theoretically has an elitist status. Is it a contextual issue right here? This man used it in order to harm Bnei Israel. Why then would you make a decree that no one should ever teach their kids Chachma Yevanit and not Lashon Yevanit? That question, by the way, the Rashi on this Gemara actually discusses that what is this Chachma Yevanit? It is actually the Lashon is Remizot. It is in a corpus of knowledge, which the Rambam confirms. It's not about certain Svarim. It's not certain. It's not logic. It's not physics. It's not Plato. It's not the knowledge. It is rimazim. It's trickery and hints. Perhaps those are the languages that Rashi uses, the Rivash uses, and the Rambam uses. Perhaps I think it may go back to sophistry. Just the use of logic to harm someone else with no other purpose. The use of logic to simply break an argument down with no intent to get to a better understanding. People in education often say, oh yeah, I use the Socratic method. You know who Socrates was? He was a bully. He just sat there and beat his students into agreeing with him. It's not necessarily a brilliant methodology, but if you use argumentation just to undercut, just to find the vulnerability and undercut without advancement, without any purpose and goal, then perhaps that seems to qualify as Chachma Yevanit. Rav Lichtenstein on this Gemara, on Sota, says there are three possibilities that you look at this Gemara. One is that this was a reaction to a particular event. Right now, nobody should be speaking Greek because the political conflicts are too hard. We cannot trust people who speak that way. The same way, unfortunately, the American government would round up Chinese, Japanese, anybody who spoke a different Asian language. We just don't know what you're doing, and we don't want to have to bother with it. So a contextual decree that gets repeated, the fact that there's two historical references here indicates that further, that because it was said in the time of Titus and then in the time of Hyrcanus, both of these times were times that were actually dangerous and limited.
Are you talking about a Jew who was speaking Greek, and he's telling the enemy how to ruin Jewish people? So what kind of person is this? It's obviously not a good person.
Right.
And it's, so maybe even more,
he was from the
Greeks.
You're not talking about the value of the language or of the culture, it's about the context.
But also, I'm sitting here very aggravated because why didn't we like the Greeks? Besides the fact they took over the country, they believed in Greek gods. They killed children because they didn't bow down or they didn't eat pigs.
There's a lot.
They were homosexuals.
There were lots of reasons in the
Greek culture that nakedness and the body.
There are lots of strong reasons in the story of Hanukkah that emerge as very troubling and very counter-Jewish, and that's consistent with what it is in Greek culture that remains a very big dividing line. We will isolate those also. Yeah, we're going to isolate those also. But let's keep going. I know there's another share that everyone goes to, that everyone would like to go to. Rav Lichtenstein then says in this case, because it's contextual, likely this is a value neutral statement, but that in the context of an enemy, you need to be very careful, and you have to be practical. Additionally, the notion that you have these atarot kalot, these literally these frills and adornments that were the custom and the style of the age that is connected to this decree, this gezeira that you shouldn't speak Greek language and you shouldn't wear these crowns, means that that this is an issue not of there being an essentially something wrong with Greek language. They thought of it as like a frill, and the Yerushalmi here also says you shouldn't teach your son Chachma Yevanit, your daughter it's like piano. You want her to feel cultured. You can teach her Greek culture, but that it is a value neutral or at most an adornment, not considered something essential. Similarly, in Menachot, Sha'al ben Dama ben Achoto shel Rabbi Yishmael et Rabbi Yishmael. You have a question that's being brought to Rabbi Yishmael. He says, listen. He says, Kagon ani shalamadati kol ha-Torah kula. I'm a very humble man. I've learned all of Torah kula. Mahu lumod chachma yivanit. So for me, you know, what's the big deal for me to learn chachma yivanit? I've already learned all of Torah. Lo yamusa. What does Rabbi Yishmael say? Lo yamusa sefer haTorah hazeh mipicha v'igata bo yamam v'layla. You know this pasuk that Torah should never leave your mouth, and you have to study it day and night. Save doksha ash einolo min hayom v'lo min halayla ulamad ba chachma yivanit. Go find a time that's not day, that's not night, and you can learn chachma yivanit. Again, the argument here is that there isn't necessarily, he could have easily just said, Chachma Yivanit is asur, done, we're not having the conversation. He said that wasn't his response. His response was, find a time that's not day, not night. In fact, if the halacha, a person has any type of needs, either practical needs, physical needs, needs for his job, then of course he's patur from Talmud Torah. And that seems to be the category that Chachma Yivanit would fall into, right? You're not putter from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. It's not the equivalent of Talmud Torah. There's an issue here of primacy. It's not an issue of asur. It's an issue of primacy. What is the primary responsibility you have? Chachma Yivanit falls below Torah or perhaps your physical necessities. There isn't a question here as to whether or not a person is allowed to learn it at all. Similarly, Taras Kahanim in Vayikur, it says, Et mishpatai ta'asu v'chukatai tishmoru v'lechat b'hem ani Hashem Elokecha, will also say that that's the argument. You have to put Torah mitzvot first. Ha'yata l'kim v'yafet v'yishkon b'olei shem. It goes together only into the olei shem. I wanted to wrap up with a couple of references before we close. Number one, I guess Rabbi Shachter referred to this today as well. The mitzvah of Hanukkah requires an interesting halacha that I think connects to this issue. The halacha of Pirsumei Nisa is one in which we are clearly celebrating and commemorating a victory, an existential victory, a commitment to, ironically, a commitment to a greater vigilance with regard to our insularity and our solitude when it comes to our surrounding culture. Today we're talking about our encounters with other cultures. You know, in the Hanukkah story, those who were the flag bearers for encounters with other cultures were the Mityavnim. And the Maccabim, who win the day for us and save, are really the opposites. They're the radicals who say no. Right? Mila Hashem Elai. We draw lines very, very clearly. They fought against the encounters. And our mitzvah of Pirsumei Nisa is that we need to light the light that reminds us of the nace and of the victory, but we need to light the light in a way that it is mifarsem to other people. We are not fulfilling our mitzvah if we don't qualify in that regard. So we time it, we think about this, the placement, so that others, right? So that our declaration of the primacy of Torah is one that we don't just hide in our house. It's one that we make sure is well projected and is clear in an encounter of sorts. The light usually, you know, we could have every, all of our mitzvah, let's say on Pesach, doesn't have a mitzvah of Pirsumei Nisa. Lots of strange things we do just to indicate and to remind ourselves of what it is that we are doing and what it is that we're commemorating. We could have done many of those kinds of mitzvot for Hanukkah, but the mitzvah is of a ner, and the ner has to be mefarsim. It has to spread out. That is a indication of that careful balance between a value of connecting to an outside culture and recognizing that it's ner ish uveso. The light is in your house. It represents you and your family. It's your ohel. It's your foundation that holds together your family and your future and your capacity to send a message. If it's an internal light that can send, that can be spread out, it has the ability to enrich and enhance, but not to die out and to feel too diluted. One idea that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein also really mentions in this great debate about how we connect with Hellenism or with Greek culture is, imagine the two prototypes of people who are in many ways similar to each other, but heroes from our different cultures. In Judaism, we hold up Iov as a man of ma'asim tovim, as a man whose entire life was dedicated to avodat Hashem. There wasn't a pigam, and that's clear. And the whole story is, by the way, written also very much in a Greek style, just that there are characters and there's dialogue and there's debate, not to mention. So you have Iov here, and there's a big struggle between justice and power. Hashem is punishing him, and he doesn't seem to deserve it. Hashem is punishing him, and he talks, and he asks, and he argues, and he cries, and he prays, and he pleads, right? That's the Jewish model. And you have Prometheus bound, who also fights on behalf of justice, goes to heaven, steals from the gods fire, brings it back to help man, and is caught doing such a terrible deed by confronting the gods, but by doing something good. And he's chained as a result to a rock permanently forever. And in that position, he still is defiant. He took on the gods for goodness, right? That injustice that he is suffering by the hands of an almighty, powerful god, Zeus, Prometheus fights and is in defiance continuously to the very end. His logic is completely coherent. There is no arguing against his justice. He is a justice-seeking figure, and even if he's been caught, he's still correct. These two characters, I think, represent where we draw our line and what is so definitively different between Hellenism and Judaism, and what it is that really was threatening us in the culture of Hanukkah that we fought against. There is no equality in Judaism between man and Hashem. This world is a world that is full of mystery, and we see ourselves as Hashem's agents of as much as possible achieving the mission that he's offered us, with no hubris, with no sense that it is everything serving us. Man is in the world. Man is not the world. The Greek differentiation of this quest for insight and knowledge and wisdom and beauty and enhancements in this world stops very short for Judaism, in the sense that it places man in on even playing field with the gods. All of mystery in this world can be categorized. All of the knowledge of this world can help us maintain control of this world. All of this world is in man. And that's the line that has to be preserved, because this world is so much bigger and greater than us. It's a very polite reminder. But I appreciate everybody else. I appreciate that you came out here. I know there are many, many more questions on the topic, but I hope this was a little bit of an insight into the distinctions between Judaism and Hellenism.